Excellent. Boy, what a beautiful day. See that sun shining in there? It's tempting just to kind of sneak out the back, but then I realized I had to preach. So, really is good to be here. As some of you know, we've been doing some work in Vernon as well. And when we're involved there, it's a three-service schedule, which is kind of crazy. Saturday night, two Sunday mornings. And so I say, coming back to here with this nice one-focus service is just so nice and refreshing. And with a three-service schedule, I can't even really sing, because if I sing through all the services by the end of the third service, I can't really speak that well, so I have to pace myself. Let me ask you a question. What is your citizenship? How many Canadian citizens are here today? Canadian citizens. How many U.S. citizens do we have? Okay. How many citizens of somewhere else other than Canada, U.S.? Well, shout out where you're citizens of. The Swiss have taken over. It's good. How many people here are dual citizens? Yeah, several dual citizens there. Interesting. How patriotic do you consider yourself? You know, one of the things I kind of envy about our neighbors south of the border is their patriotism. I sometimes wish Canadians would be more patriotic than we are. One time, it was Canada Day, and in the condo complex we live in the Okanagan, they have, you know, pretty strict strata rules. In fact, we call them strata Nazi. I don't know if it's really fair, but they're really strict, these people. They make sure you follow all the rules. And one of the rules is you can't hang anything, you know, on your deck, that kind of thing. But one Canada Day, there's just, you couldn't tell it was Canada Day. You know, there's nothing there to show it was Canada Day, so I pulled out a flag that I had and hung it over our deck, you know, hung it off the edge of the deck there. You could see it from the parking lot, see it from the street, and I just thought I had to do something about Canada Day. And I took it down before I got the letter from the Strata Council saying they were going to fine me if I didn't smarten up. But again, I wish sometimes we were just a little bit more patriotic about our different nations. Here's one definition of a patriot I came across. A patriot is someone who gets a parking ticket and then rejoices that the country's working. It's a different one. How many people get a parking ticket or a speeding ticket and say, "Oh, feels so good to be a Canadian. I'm so happy the country is working." Well, we're in this series in the book of Philippians, and we've seen from the start of it the last couple of weeks with Pastor Matt, this interesting little group of people, letter written to the church in Philippi. And what's interesting about this city of Philippi is that they had a very interesting little patriotic citizenship nationalism thing going on in Philippi. The city was about 1,000 kilometers from the city of Rome, but it was considered a Roman colony. And so Philippi, the city of Philippi, the soil in Philippi was considered Roman soil. And if you were a citizen of Philippi, you were a Roman citizen. And they took great pride. They were kind of like a special city. They were Roman laws. They were Roman citizens. It was a special city. And they knew they were special. And they had kind of this combined civic pride and national pride. They were proud to be Philippians, and they were proud to be Romans. It kind of went together. It's not unlike people who, you know, some that you hear, that you have the pride of having the wisdom to park in the Columbia Valley. That, you know, it is the promised land. You're not letting too many people know, but you know it's the place. And you're proud to be here. And then you also have another layer maybe of pride of being a Canadian citizen or whatever country you are a citizen of. And that's kind of how it was in Philippi here. They had this sense of civic pride. Now, there's a story that makes a little more sense when you understand that situation. Back in the book of Acts, actually, Acts 16, a fairly well-known story of Paul and Silas in Philippi. And Paul and Silas are in Philippi, and this is the situation where this demonized girl was kind of talking about them and prophesying, and they ended up casting the spirit out. They ended up going to prison. They got flogged. It says they were stripped and beaten with rods. They were severely flogged. You know, that's a story where they're singing songs at midnight and the prison doors open. The prison guard, the prison warden and his family get saved. But then the next morning, very interesting, the magistrate sent their officers to the jailer and said, "Release these men." The jailer told Paul, "The magistrates have ordered you and Silas to be released. Now you can go." But Paul said to the officers, "They beat us publicly without a trial, even though we're Roman citizens. They threw us into prison. And now they want to get rid of us quietly? No. Let them come themselves and escort us out." The officers reported this to the magistrates. And when they heard that Paul and Silas were Roman citizens, they were alarmed. They came to appease them and escorted them from the prison, requesting them to leave the city. See, what happened there was actually, it was a huge embarrassment. It was a political embarrassment. It was a legal faux pas. They could have been in serious trouble because this was the Roman city that followed Roman law, and here they had misused Roman citizens. And it kind of struck at the core of that identity that these Philippian people had. And that'll kind of help us. That mindset, that understanding of Philippi will help a little bit in understanding the passage you're looking at this morning, which is in Philippians chapter 1, starting in verse 27. Just a few innocuous little verses here that say something I think pretty important to us today. It says this, Philippians 1, 27. Whatever happens, as citizens of heaven, live in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then whether I come and see you or only hear of you in my absence, I will know that you stand firm in one spirit, striving together with one accord for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. This is a sign to them that they will be destroyed, but that you'll be saved, and that by God. For it's been granted to you on behalf of Christ not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for him, since you're going through the same struggle you saw I had and now hear that I still have. Whatever happens, he says, as citizens, and then in brackets in my Bible, of heaven, as citizens, live in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. And what he's essentially saying in this passage to these proud Philippians, proud Roman citizens, he's saying, show your true citizenship. Show who you really are. Show where your citizenship really is by the way you're conducting yourselves. Live a life worthy of your citizenship. Now, this word for citizen here means it's really the idea of a colony of foreigners. People are living outside their own country in a colony, but representing their country. So he's saying, you're representing another country. You're these proud Philippian Romans, but you're actually citizens of somewhere else. And you're called to represent that somewhere else where you live right now. And so to the proud Philippians, the proud Canadians, the proud Americans, the proud Swiss, whoever he's talking to here, all of us here, he's saying, if you're a follower of Jesus, show your true citizenship. Be patriotic in the right way. Live out the implications of being a citizen of the gospel, a citizen of heaven. Now, what does it look like to actually live out that citizenship? Well, he tells us in this passage, two simple little traits I want to highlight that show what it means to be citizens of the gospel or citizens of heaven, no matter where you live, where your citizenship on this earth really is. There was a story in National Geographic back in the day when the magazines before the videos really. It was a story following the Arctic wolf. And these Arctic wolves would, prey on all kinds of things. At one point, these wolves came across a herd of muskox. And of course, they wanted to target these little baby muskox. So the muskox, what they do? They circle up, right? These muskox circle up, and there's this big wall, and all the babies are kind of in the middle. And what happened as this photojournalist was kind of following this attack, these wolves kept kind of going after these muskox until they broke ranks. Until one kind of ran out, and then they just scattered, and the wolves cleaned up the entire brood of young muskox. There wasn't one young muskox left. That's what happened when the unity was broken in that situation. Now compare that to this video clip I'm going to show you. It's a fairly famous video clip. I've edited it down. It's about an 8-minute clip. I'm sure some of you have seen it. 82 million people have seen it, so some of you have. It's called A Battle at Kruger. It's an interaction between some lions and some Cape buffalo. And so let's take a look at this little clip in contrast to the muskox.
That is a huge buffalo.
That's a huge buffalo.
It's a huge buffalo.
Even the lion.
Oh, they're too young. The one's gone already.
Don't you think they're around the other way?
Is it a little?
I think they're a bit young. I don't know. Maybe.
Oh, he's looking at me.
They're getting ready.
They're crouching.
She's quite big.
Does that mean attack position?
No, it's a touch.
What are we going to do?
She's going to do this.
Oh my God.
Can I grab the baby?
Oh my God.
Oh,
She's going for him. She's going for him. She's going for him. She got him. Oh, she did. She got him.
Hey, these gun is just clapped a buffalo, yeah.
Oh my God.
God, did you see that?
Four coming.
I'm running out of film.
Yeah, she's all right.
Chasing, come on.
Oh, they're too late.
Yeah, you realize it?
Oh, look at the teeth.
Look at them. They got a chase.
Look at the teeth, Jay. Look at them. You're too late.
Jesus.
You're too late. Yeah.
You guys, you cannot believe what's going on here. There's a big tally here between lions, crocodiles, and buffaloes.
Look at them all.
Whoa. He swatted at him, he kicked at him. He's kicking at him, look. He's kicking at him.
Never seen
that. I've never seen
anyone. The calf's still alive.
It is?
Yeah, it's trying to get away. It's standing up.
It is, it's still alive. Oh, is it?
Oh,
I'm
going to the middle of the water.
It's standing up.
It's standing up.
It ran away. No, it's got us back.
It's got it back.
They've got him back. They do have him back.
Oh, hierdie buffels het die leeuws weggevat van haar kleintje af.
Yeah, they're leaving.
They're going back. They're coming to the other ones.
We're still chasing.
Oh, check, check.
Back in the cahoot.
Oh, he's going to stop.
And the two lions.
Oh, they're going back. This is the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
I've never seen them.
Look, they're running. Look at them running.
There's two left.
Gee, they chased him away.
But they hooked the one. Did you see
that?
Look at
this. They
hooked the one. Come on, buffalo. Go on. And there's another one.
Oh, the big one.
Oh,
run.
It's actually, there's a couple of interesting things that you don't see in that. At one point when the baby Cape buffalo's in the water, a crocodile actually grabs it as well. And they have to pull, the lions pull away from the crocodile to get up onto the land. And another clip, one of the buffalo actually catches a lion and gives him a flip and sends him spinning. It took them a while to kind of get their head together there. But once the buffaloes kind of got organized and oriented, there was no real chance of those lions resisting. In fact, if the buffalo only knew, they could just form a wall and walk towards those lions, and the lions either moved or they get trampled. That there's really no comparison of power between that herd, that unified herd of Cape buffalo, and a pride of lions. Whatever happens, it says in our passage, as citizens of heaven, live in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I'll know that you stand firm in one spirit, striving together with one accord for the faith of the gospel. It's saying part of your citizenship is a sense of unity. And that's the picture I want you to bear in mind, this unified front. The part of what it means to be citizen is to have this unified front. It's not kind of a warm, fuzzy, you know, holding hands around the campfire, singing kumbaya, unity. It's an active, almost militant kind of unity. It talks about here unity contending for the faith of the gospel. Unity contending for the faith of the gospel. I think we're froze up there. If you can move it along, that'd be great. There we go. Excellent. Got her. Thanks. Let me ask the question. If this is what we're fighting for, if this is what we're contending for, what actually is the gospel? Do you know what it is? What's the gospel? What is this thing that we're contending for, that we're taking a stand for? Well, on one level, the basic gospel is the fact that Jesus Christ died on the cross to pay the price for our sins so we could be forgiven. That's on the personal level, that's the gospel. But when you pull back a bit, there's a bigger picture that he's forming a new people, a new nation, a new citizenship. And when you pull back even further, book of Colossians puts it this way. Colossians 1:19, God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him in Jesus, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. The fullness of the gospel is that God is fixing everything through Jesus. not just our personal relationship with him, not just larger family relationships, but creation that is broken. He is restoring it and will restore it. That is the full picture of the gospel. It's a story, it's a truth that can change lives, that can actually change the world. And so it says that we're supposed to contend for that. We're supposed to strive for that. It's a military picture. It's an athletic picture. It's the picture of those buffalo coming in as a front to push back. It's a picture of what the muskox would do if they didn't break ranks, or they'd maintain this united front. And we contend for the gospel by proclaiming it and by protecting it from false teaching. There's a story from years ago where there was a county fair, and there's this horse pulling contest to see which horse could pull the most weight on a sled. And the winning horse pulled 4,500 pounds, which is a lot of weight. Runner-up pulled 4,000 pounds. Somebody had the idea, let's hook them together, see what they can do. They hooked these two horses together that could pull a combined weight of 8,500 pounds, but together they were able to pull 12,000 pounds, almost triple what either one of them could do. That's a picture of the power of what it means when we are unified. Some of you may recall we're in the season of transition. We had these key result areas, stuff we were working on during transition. One of the key result areas had to do with spiritual and relational renewal, and this was the statement. It's a long time ago. Maybe you don't remember it. Part of what we're trying to do is recognizing and addressing entrenched patterns of interpersonal conflict, gossip, and unforgiveness. That wherever we saw there was conflict and unforgiveness and gossip, we wanted to identify it and deal with it because it was counter to the unity. One of the things we did, you may remember this. Some of you may remember the triangle. How many people remember the triangle? The triangle is when I've got a problem with Dave, I go talk to Howie. And now I formed a triangle, a relational triangle. And I've actually created a wedge in our relationship. We talk about how wrong it is that when I have an issue with someone, or you have an issue with someone, we go talk to someone else in gossip and try to get people to take sides. And we talk about, well, how do you break those triangles? Well, one of the ways you break the triangle is by calling it what it is, that it is actually gossip. It's sin, it's destructive, it's actually demonic, satanic, because it breaks that unity. We talked about how we need to take the initiative. We got a problem with someone, we need to go talk to them. We take the initiative rather than forming the triangle, and ultimately, we need to, if we've been kind of the wrong part in the triangle, we need to forgive and deal with that. And that was part of how we were called to deal with this issue of broken relationships. Now, the season of transition, preparing for a new lead pastor, is a time to recalibrate and reset and refocus on what matters. And what matters is the gospel. That we're called to contend for the gospel. That somehow it seems that we're wired to fight. What we should be fighting for is for the gospel. A unified front standing for the name and the cause and the purpose of Jesus Christ. That's really the first trait, that unity around the gospel. It's a situation where we're fighting for the same thing, so we have each other's backs. We're not stabbing each other's backs, we have each other's backs. That we have a place, and not just a location, but a context, a community, where it's safe. Where you know you're on the same team. Where I've got your back and you got my back, where you can completely be yourself. I know that even though you're imperfect, you're loved, you're welcome, you're part of the family. That's the implication of the gospel in a local church community. That's the trait number one. Second trait says this. Talks about this striving together with one accord for the faith of the gospel without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. This is a sign that they'll be destroyed, but that you'll be saved, and that by God. It's been granted to you on behalf of Christ not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for him, since you're going through the same struggle you saw I had, and now here I still have. The second trait, the second part of this gospel citizenship, is that we'll have courage in the face of opposition and suffering. That when something comes along that would scare us, we don't scatter. That we maintain that united front, that we don't let opposition push us back. It says something interesting here. It says you've been granted. You've been granted on behalf of Christ not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for him. The way it's described, it says, it's like you've been given the gift of suffering. You've been given the great opportunity to suffer for Jesus. Well, why is that a gift? It sounds more like a punishment. What's the gift in suffering for Christ? Well, part of the gift is, as he's saying here, if you are contending together for the gospel, if you're fighting for the gospel and you're opposed, you know you've got it right. That the gift is that you're right and you're on the winning side. That's the gift of it. It says in 2 Timothy that whoever wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. Jesus said to his disciples, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. You're blessed." Why? Because that's exactly the way he says they treated the prophets. That's exactly the way the world treats anybody who stands for what is right and true and proper. And what he says here is that suffering, if you're contending for the gospel, that suffering is proof that you're on the right team. Now, why do we suffer specifically? How do we suffer? You know, it's interesting. I think I've shared with you before in reading about the persecuted church how we tend to be grateful that we can gather in freedom. The truth is, in most of the world, people can gather in freedom as Christians. It's the proclamation of the gospel that gets you in trouble. As long as we're in our little holy huddle, in our own space, doing our own thing, it's all good. As soon as we try to proclaim it, that's where we get into trouble. There's this people, you might have heard of this great group, People for Good. Interesting group of people. They kind of build around the golden rule. They had this cool little campaign where they had these double-sized t-shirts. And they see two people walking down the street as friends. They say, "Hey, would you put these shirts on? Just to show, you know, a picture of unity, a picture of being on the same team." And great slogan, "The human race is a team sport." I think they're doing some good stuff. This whole idea of being positive and neighborly and everything else. But what, you know, one of their ads, one of their little campaigns, at the end of their little video, it had this statement. "No one is born bad." No one is born bad. That's not what my mom would say, actually. That's not honestly what I would say about my kids. Or even my most perfect little granddaughters. One of whom just turned 5 the other day. How long does it take before a kid starts acting like the world revolves around them? 5 seconds. How much do we have to work to teach someone to be self-centered? We don't. They inherit it from us. And if you want to argue that point, I mean, I've got all of history and the news headlines on my side today. The permeation of self-centeredness through our culture and our world is undeniable. David said in Psalm 51, "Surely I've been a sinner from birth, sinner from the time my mother conceived me." The gospel, which is good news, is only good news because there's some bad news. The bad news is that we need forgiveness. The good news is that we can be forgiven. The bad news is that our relationship with God is broken. The good news is that relationship can be fixed. And that might be offensive to you. It's certainly offensive in different parts of this world, but it's part of the gospel. There is no good news without the bad news. That's why Jesus had to die. And every now and then I bump into Christians who think, you know, well, we're all pretty good. It's, you know, we're all pretty good. But then I say, well, why did Jesus have to die if it's all good? Had a cartoon once that says, if I'm okay and you're okay, what's he doing on the cross? The bad news leads us to the good news. But if you want to get even more offensive, let's see what Jesus said. "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Jesus said that. Jesus said that. The uniqueness of Jesus is offensive. The idea that he's not just a good leader, that he's not just a wise man, but he is God the Son, that he is the way, not a way. The truth, not a truth. The life, not a way to life. He is the one. He is the reference point. And in our whatever you believe, as long as you're sincere culture, that's offensive. To say that there is one way, and it's the person of Jesus Christ. That's the gospel. And it says here, whatever happens as citizens of heaven, live in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I'll know you stand firm in one spirit, striving together with one accord for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. So here's what it means to be citizens of heaven. Citizens of the gospel, citizens of Christ. It means that we're unified, working together for the gospel. The fact that Jesus died, that he is the way. And it means that when there is opposition, we don't break ranks. We maintain a united front, and we continue proclaiming the gospel. What does it look like here and now? Well, here's a few thoughts to land this morning. I think it means examining what you've been fighting for. What do you fight for? What are you passionate for? What do you push for? Is it something other than the gospel of Christ? Something trivial like your rights or your preferences or your comfort. If it's something other than Christ, repent of that and find others who want to contend for the faith of the gospel with you. I think part of what it means here to be citizens, it means to be courageous in what we stand for as a church. We stand for the gospel. We stand for global missions. We believe missions are important because the gospel is important. The reason we send missionaries is because people need to hear about Jesus. It means we stand for the deeper life, for healing, for a king who's coming back, even though a lot of those things aren't popular in our current religious fads, even in Christian circles. I think it means preparing our hearts and our minds for suffering as we do these things. And understand that the goal of life as Christians is not to be as comfortable, as safe, as secure, as mainstream, as cool as possible, but to be as gospel-centered, as Christ-centered as possible. To be the best representatives of Jesus that we can be, come what may, and not to back off. And understand that if we do that and there's opposition, it's okay. It's okay. I think it means also that we just, in some ways, need to become countercultural. That we're not on the same team as the larger culture. We stand for something else. We need to start acting not like consumers, but like soldiers on assignment, discerning where God wants us and plugging in for the duration, working together, fighting together, back to back, completely unified for what really matters. I used to speak a lot in the non-church, in the secular world, talking to businesses and organizations. I talked a lot about team dynamics, teamwork. And I would start a lot of my talks with this simple little story. Story of a man who once went to tour a lunatic asylum. An asylum for the criminally insane. That's what they called them back in the day. And he goes into this asylum, and he's surprised to discover there's only two or three guards, even though there's dozens of prisoners. And he asked the guards, he said, "Aren't you concerned that these inmates are going to unite and overpower you and just escape?" The guard just laughed. Shook his head, said, "Nah. Nothing to worry about. Something you need to understand. Lunatics never unite. Lunatics never unite. Locusts do. Cape Buffalo do. Christians must. It's about unity, but being united about the gospel, the good news of Jesus. Let me read it again. Whatever happens, as citizens of heaven, live in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then whether I come to see you or only hear about you, I'll know you stand firm in one spirit, striving together with one accord for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. That's what it means to be citizens of the gospel. That's what's needed in the next era in this church and in this community among God's people. Would you stand with me? Let's pray together.